Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Hilton Anchorage, where President of the Denali Gas Pipeline, Bud Fackrell, is addressing the Alaska World Affairs Council. Recorded on Friday, October 30th, his talk entitled Denali, an update on the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project, a world-class effort with global implications, is coming up next on KSKA after the news.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Welcome. I'm Lisa Falska. I'm the director of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Unfortunately, Rod could not be with us, but I am happy to have you all here on this blustery day. And we are recording this program for radio and TV, so if you wouldn't mind turning off those phones. And also at the end, please wait for the microphone to come to you because we will be recording your questions. And Michael Cook is on the side recording today's program for KSKA. The program today will be available online at kska.org. And now I'd like to introduce our head table. To my immediate left, Bud Fackrell, and to the far left, Bob Iden, and Cheryl Hines, who will introduce our speaker. Cheryl.
The last time I introduced a president of an oil company, I married him, so.
Well, there we go.
Today, it is my distinct honor to introduce Bud Fackrell. Bud has worked in the oil and gas industry for over 30 years, with much of his career spent overseas. Since 2006, Bud has been based in Anchorage. Bud graduated in 1975 with a B.S. in petroleum engineering from the University of Wyoming. He began his career with Amoco, handling drilling, completion, workover, and production activities, and provided expert witness as a regulatory engineer. From 1980 to 1987, Bud was a district engineer managing Amoco's engineering activities in the Gulf of Suez. From 1991 to 1995, he led the development of a gas strategy and execution plan as the Trinidad Gas Asset Manager. In 1995, Bud was selected as the Executive Assistant to the International Group Vice President of Amoco. He was also appointed Lead Representative for the Upstream Group to develop a process for all of Amoco's operating companies to ensure that major projects deliver best-in-class results. In 1996, Bud served as the Gulf of Suez District General Manager for BP Amoco. Bud was then responsible for BP's extensive natural gas assets in Wyoming from 2000 to 2002. He functioned as the asset delivery manager there. From 2002 to 2006, Bud served as the general manager and CEO officer of the Abu Dhabi Marine Operation Company, a large joint venture company operating all of the offshore concessions on behalf of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, BP, Total, and the Japan Oil Development Company in the Emirate of Abu Dhabi. Bud transferred to Anchorage in August 2006, where he served as the Senior Vice President of BP Exploration with accountability for all operations of the consolidated team. Bud was appointed President of Denali, the Alaska Gas Pipeline LLC, in June 2008. We look forward to hearing his update on that project, as well as its global implications. May I present Bud Fackrell.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, it's really a great pleasure being here with you today. I actually got
a little tired when I listen to that long itinerary of all the places I've been. I'm sure many of you are in the same situation. It's amazing to look back on life and, you know, 35 years, look at your career and where it's gone, and here we are in Anchorage, Alaska, working on, I think, one of the most exciting projects I've ever worked on. And my goal today is to tell you a little bit about Denali, what we're doing on the project, and then talk about some of the risks of the project as well. And I look forward to also having your questions and getting in a conversation about that. Let's see if I can make this work. There we go. So who are we, first of all? Denali is formed about 18 months ago. It's a joint venture between BP and ConocoPhillips. We're very familiar with those two companies here in Alaska. It's a new company. It's a legal entity both in the U.S. and in Canada. Our project headquarters is here in Anchorage. You've probably seen us on C Street between Benson and Northern Lights. We have about 40,000 square feet in the building there that we've rented. Great space. We're the only tenants in the building, which is also great. Lots of nice parking in there. We also have an office in Calgary where we have a team that works the Canadian part of the project. Well, I guess the first question to ask is, why were we formed? And I think it really starts with, there's a large known natural gas resource on the North Slope that for years has the state of Alaska, the leaseholders have been trying to monetize. It is a gigantic complex project, and that project is going to require I think exceptional skills in project management. It's also going to require some very strong financial basis to be able to finance the project in the end. And in the end, Denali was formed by our owners for just those reasons. But it really all starts on the North Slope. And I think anytime we talk about the natural gas project, we need to start with a gas resource base. Here's a slide showing the North Slope operation and the existing fields that are on production up there today. If you'll notice, BP and ConocoPhillips operate about 99% of the production on the North Slope today. Only this small Aguric field that Pioneer recently put on production is not operated by one of these two companies. Exxon is the operator of the Point Thompson field off to the right, but as you're all probably aware, it's not on production yet. There's 35 TCF of known resources that have been discovered on the North Slope. And the USGS indicates there's 100 to 200 TCF of additional resources yet to be discovered. So it is a very big resource base. And for both Conoco and BP, this is one of the largest resource bases that hasn't been monetized in their portfolio. If you look at the slide down to the bottom on the right-hand corner, you'll see who has the leaseholds on the gas of that 35 TCF. BP and ConocoPhillips hold about 50% of that leasehold. ExxonMobil's a player, Chevron, and then the state of Alaska obviously has its royalty interest. And we don't want to forget about that royalty interest when you're talking about this resource base. So that's where it all starts, and that's the kind of the reason that we were formed, is to try to move that project forward. The project starts on the North Slope of Alaska in Prudhoe Bay. And actually, there will be a very large gas treatment plant built at Prudhoe Bay. Sometimes we only talk about the pipeline, but there's actually a mega project itself in the gas treatment plant. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. We then follow the TAPS, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, down to Delta Junction. At Delta Junction, we will head down the Alcon Highway into Alberta. In Alberta, there's several ways to get the gas out. There's actually three or four different ways to move gas to North American markets. We'll either use those systems, or if customers desire, we could build new pipe from Alberta down to North America. I did also want to point out, we're targeting delivering 4 billion cubic feet a day to North American markets. That's about 6 to 8% of the current demand in the U.S. So this is a significant volume of gas moving into North American markets. Anytime we talk about a pipeline, you really need to understand the regulatory framework in which it will be approved. This is a federally approved pipeline. It really isn't going to be approved by the state of Alaska. It will be approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in the U.S. and the National Energy Board in Canada. The pipeline will be an open access pipeline. Any person who wants to secure space on the line will have a fair opportunity to do that. Secondly, there's no proponent out there that has any exclusive right to this pipeline. It's essentially open to whoever can deliver the markets and make the pipeline economic. In the U.S., as I mentioned, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is responsible for authorizing and regulating the project. And that's actually by virtue of a congressional mandate. Secondly, we've all heard of the Alaska Gas Inducement Act, AGIA. It's a license to build a pipeline. It has some funding and some provisions in it, but it's not a permit to build the pipeline under FERC. And we're proceeding outside of the AGIA process. It's a point I'll make several times. The Denali project is using risk money from our owners. We're not using any money from the state of Alaska. In Canada, we will be using the National Energy Board process to authorize and regulate the project. This is open to any pipeline who may want, or any company that may want to build a pipeline in Canada. The NEB process also incorporates all of the modern environmental regulations that have taken place over the years in Canada. In addition to that, I'm happy to report that the Government of Canada has also set up a major projects management office exclusively for the Denali project. So this will allow us to have a single window approach into all of the environmental laws and regulatory bodies in Canada. And there are a number of those. There's actually the equivalent of the EPA called CEA. The NEB has its own process, and in the Yukon Territory, they have an environmental process as well. This MPO office will allow us to funnel all those together. The other really important fact here is that the NEB and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission work together, and they have a long history of building and moving gas across the borders of the U.S. Canada supplies a large volume of gas to the U.S., and in fact, there's Canadian gas that goes into from Western Canada into the U.S. and then moves back into Eastern Canada. So the project is important for both countries. There are benefits to both in that arena. Well, up to date, we've really made significant progress in the last 18 months. Our first major milestone will be conducting what's called an open season in 2010. And later on, I'm going to talk about open season in a little more detail, kind of give you a 101 on open season. As we go around and talk to people, we use this term all the time, and I find out that a lot of people don't know what we're talking about. So for right now, our first major milestone is open season, which in short is the opportunity for people to sign up to put gas in our pipeline. We spent over $120 million in the last 18 months. Again, risk money from BP and ConocoPhillips moving the project forward. We currently have a team of 80 to 90 people between Anchorage and Calgary. We've made really significant progress on the regulatory front. FERC has a process where you actually pre-file your application. We did that in June of last year. We've been working very closely with FERC, and it's been very helpful to us. We filed a right-of-way for the federal lands in Alaska, which is about a third of the pipeline route in Alaska. And on the Canadian side, I've already mentioned that we've been very active with the NEB and then forming this major projects management office in Canada as well. As part of the project for open season, we will have to put together a cost estimate. We'll have to have the design of the pipeline, the routing more detailed for customers. A big part of that has been gathering field data, analyzing and integrating this field data together. And I'm going to show you what that looks like here in just a minute. The gas treatment plant on the North Slope, again, we've been very involved in engineering work on it, have a major contract there with a big worldwide engineering company. Same thing on the pipeline itself. We have a an engineering contract there. We've been working the pipeline and the compressor stations that will exist on the pipeline. A very big part of this project is shareholder engagement. And by that I mean, or stakeholder, excuse me. By that I mean the people who live up and down the corridor, but also all the agencies and communities that may be involved. We've had a very extensive program interacting with many, many groups between here in Alaska and in Canada. And then really finally, that one of the big things we're doing is building the cost estimate. How much is the pipeline going to cost? The last time this project had a cost estimate was 2001. BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon spent $125 million putting a cost estimate together. Any numbers you've seen on the cost of the project are really that cost estimate escalated to 2009. So we've started with that data, and we're rebuilding the cost estimate to be part of our open season offering, a very important part. And then finally, again, we're working on all the commercial preparations to conduct an open season in 2010. So 2009 has been an extremely busy year for us. I was just commenting to somebody this morning, is last week we had people in Calgary working, Long Beach, California, Houston, here in Anchorage. I was in Canada, and we had a team in Washington meeting with FERC, just spread out all over trying to pull all these things together. So let's talk about the gas treatment plant. The gas coming out of Prudhoe Bay has carbon dioxide in it. Carbon dioxide is very corrosive. It also has some other impurities. We've got to remove all the carbon dioxide and impurities, compress the gas, and then chill the gas. One of the reasons we're going to chill the gas is that we want to bury the pipeline. And if it's warm, we'll have subsidence on the permafrost that we're crossing. We hired the joint venture between Fluor and Worley Parsons to help us with the engineering on the gas treatment plant, and we really consider these companies to be foremost in process engineering. We believe we really hit the top of the class in that regard. The project itself is going to be an enormous project. If you look at the down to the bottom right-hand side of the slide, I don't know how many of you have ever been to Prudhoe Bay, but there are existing two plants up there right now, CGF and CCP. The GTP plant, as you'll see here, is going to be larger than both of those put together. It will be the largest gas treatment plant of its kind anywhere in the world. As I said, we'll be compressing the gas. The module that you see on the left-hand side is 5,000-ton module. That's the biggest module we've ever installed on the North Slope. Some of the modules we're going to install in this plant are going to be 8,000 tons. So it's an enormous size project. The other thing I think we're going to be really proud about is this is going to be a green design. All of the compressors we're using, will be the latest technology, the turbines. We will extract CO2. That CO2 will be sequestered back in the ground. So we think it's going to be environmentally very friendly from that standpoint. Now, talking about the pipeline itself, I like this picture. It's an artist's depiction of the TAPS pipeline on the right, which we're all familiar with. It's elevated. And then the Denali pipeline on the left, which is just a cutout here, which will be buried. This is going to be a large diameter pipeline, 48 inches. It's going to be about an inch thick. The TAPS pipeline is about half an inch thick, so it's a huge piece of pipe. We will be pressuring the gas to 2,500 PSI. What that does is there will be no liquids in the gas. You know, propanes and ethanes and so forth will actually be in a gaseous phase in the line. And a technical term on that is we're going to cram as much gas as we can in the pipeline. And that allows us to do that, the size, the strength of the pipe itself. Again, as I mentioned, it's going to be buried. We will have compressor stations about every 100 to 200 miles along the pipeline route. A really important part here in Alaska is with the energy crisis that we have facing us is we will have offtake points in Alaska. We'll have at least 5 offtake points where you can take gas off. We'll also have an appropriate number in Canada. And then finally, as I mentioned before, we're going to deliver 4 billion cubic feet of natural gas to North American markets. The pipeline is long. It's 2,000 miles long. You're looking at 2 to 3 million tons of steel. It could be more than that if we need to build the pipe from Alberta down to the Chicago area. We're really happy on the pipeline side that we've hired Bechtel, a world-class engineering firm, to work with us on the pipeline design and the compressor station design. And they're helping us with engineering cost estimating, scheduling, and so forth. We also have, I want to mention, CH2M Hills, very involved with us on the project, one of our local engineering firms here. This is what we call an alignment sheet. Lots and lots of data on here, but if you look at the top part, it's an aerial view of the pipeline route. There's about 50 miles on there, and this is on the North Slope as you come from the North Slope south into the Brooks Range. I wanted to throw it up there because in the end, we're going to design this pipeline almost a foot by foot, and if you look down the list here, there's mileposts, there's a profile of what the elevation looks like, the longitudinal and cross slope, what the work pad is, the terrain we're going to be in, the ditch mode. As we go out and get field data, we populate this alignment sheet. So this is only 50 miles. We have alignment sheets across the entire 2,000 miles of the pipeline. So pretty extensive engineering that goes into it. And that helps us, again, design and be able to build the project at the cost that we think it is. I want to just kind of use a little technology here. How many of you are familiar with Google Earth out there? Our engineers have taken Google Earth and really put together a really kind of neat passage of basically this same area. So I'm going to just take you on a little show here through Attigan Pass, which is the highest point on the pipeline. So here you are moving down the route, and we're going from north to south. So heading into the Brooks Range, the dark purple line is our pipeline route. That faded line that we cross is the TAPS line. And the numbers are mileposts as you move along. So here we are. We turn up, and now we're heading up through Attigan Pass. It really makes the project come to life, doesn't it, when you see it in this perspective? Over the pass, and we'll head off down through the Brooks Range, here out into the Chandelier Shelf as we move off the elevation. You can also see some of the rivers that come through and cross. So I mentioned stakeholder engagement. I wanted to talk a little bit about that. I think this is one of the more important things that we have to do, is make sure that we are engaged with the local communities and the agencies up and down the route. And part of this will play out in construction as well, so we build a relationship, understand what their capabilities are to help us as we move forward with the project, but also to meet whatever needs that they have. So we've actually had over 200 public meetings, both here in Alaska and Canada. We've met with all of the Native groups up and down the route here. And in Canada, we've met with all the Aboriginal First Nation groups in Canada as well. And as we progress, we'll work towards having cooperation agreements with the appropriate bodies up down the route. We've also started looking at workforce development. During construction of the project, you're going to have 10,000 people working on it. But that's a very short window. That's, you know, a three-year window. The project will bring lots of wealth to both countries, and there'll be jobs created off of that. So we've been looking at how we can help the communities. And one of the things we've done is we actually had an archaeological training program with the University of Alaska Fairbanks last summer. And we had a survey apprentice training program just here recently, which is I think was really a success, because these were people from the local communities, and we actually teamed with, I forget all who it is, but it was Alaska Labor, U.S. Labor, the Teamsters, the surveyors in the area. And even if these people won't work for Denali, they will be trained surveyors that can work on any project that comes about in our industry, and we'll continue to do that. We've established working relationships with the government agencies, and if you look at the bottom, it's alphabet soup there at the bottom, but there are lots of agencies involved. I mentioned a few. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is extremely important. In addition to that, Congress has set up what's called the Office of the Federal Coordinator, which is there to oversee the project and help bring all the federal bodies together. In Canada, there's the National Energy Board, and I mentioned CEA, YESA, the Major Projects Management Office. We've now established a relationship with each of these agencies. We have a work plan that we review with them. And in particular with FERC, they aren't just going to approve your application when you submit it one day. They want to be involved with you as you move the project along, versus one day you turn in a 1,000-page report to have it approved. So it's a very iterative process. It's a big part of the project, and it's one we spent a lot of time on. Well, one of the more important things we're working on this year is the cost estimate, as I mentioned. It's an enormous undertaking. If you look at just all the things that go into this cost estimate, it's almost mind-boggling. Climate data, pipe storage yards, construction plans, chemical technical engineering, thermodynamic hydraulic modeling, the GTP process selection, labor, materials, stakeholder dialogue, and then logistics. Pipelines are about logistics in the end. They're about moving people, moving equipment, moving pipe up and down the route. So putting a cost estimate on a project that's a ways away is always a difficult undertaking. We will have our cost estimate finished in the next month or two. We feel very good about the progress we've made on it, and I really believe we will have the best credible cost estimate the project has ever had. I think when we go to shippers with our terms and conditions, I think they should have a lot of confidence in the work that we've done in this area. And this is one of the biggest risks of the project is how much is it going to cost? I'm really proud of this particular slide. These are all the different contractors and companies that have been working with us over the last 18 months. They aren't all working with us every day, but as I mentioned, we have 80 to 90 people on our CAR team. We have dozens of other people that work with us depending on what we're doing. And it's funny, as we built this slide, I always leave a meeting and somebody comes up and says, "I've been working with you. We want our logo on your slide." But most of these are very familiar. They're Alaska contractors or they're big companies who have offices here in Alaska, or I could say the same thing on the Canada side. They're very involved with our cost estimate and building the project up. So let's talk about open season for a few minutes. So this is more open season 101. And so I hope when you leave here, when someone says open season, you'll understand what it is. Open seasons is the process that allows gas producers and other entities to reserve space on a pipeline, making long-term financial commitments to the project. So what we have to do is go get financing for this $30 to $40 billion project. We've got to have some sort of collateral. The producers who own the gas make firm financial commitments to us. That's what we take to the bank. Open season is the process that allows everyone fair and open access, and this is governed by FERC. As I said, there's open access to the capacity on the pipeline. It provides a forum for negotiating terms and conditions, again, under FERC's jurisdiction. And in Canada, it's the National Energy Board. It's an assessment that the project is right-sized for the market needs. You know, right now we're assuming we can deliver 4 billion cubic feet of gas to North American markets. When we go to open season, we're going to find out what the producers actually believe they can deliver and where they want that gas to go. So there'll be some negotiations involved in that. If you look at the timeline down here, Alaska is the only a pipeline project that has its own open season rules because it is so important. And this is actually a FERC-established timeline. There's actually three pieces of it. In the center is a 90-day period that is actually open season. preceding that is a 90-day period where you actually file your application, get public comments. FERC approves your application. And there's a series of 21 things that we have to file with FERC to be able to conduct the open season. And then after that is a period of time where you're trying to sign agreements with those parties who nominated. You'll post your results, and then you'll file copies of the precedent agreements. So it's really a six-month period, but the open season itself is that 90-day period in the middle. A very important concept for any project, but it's particularly a very important project for this particular project. And we will be conducting our open season in 2010. So let me wrap up, and then we can take some questions. What does a successful project really mean? It's about jobs and business opportunities here in Alaska and in Canada. It also provides an opportunity for exploration of both oil and gas up and down this pipeline route. If you think of it, we're going to have a 2,000-mile corridor, and we cross many sedimentary basins where oil and gas could exist. Right now, there's no outlet for that, particularly if they find gas. So it's quite a boom in leveraging for exploration. It also extends the economic life of North Slope Reserves. I mean, all of us in this room are familiar that, you know, we're producing a third of what we did a few years ago on the North Slope. This allows us to extend the reserves of the fields that exist up there. It's also a major revenue stream for both Alaska and Canada. This is important to Canada. Their resource base is dwindling, and they want to fill it up with a gas source. It provides revenue for them as well as it does for us. And then a big one is it supplies a secure domestic supply to North American markets. In order for the project to go forward, it's really about managing project risks in the end. And a pipeline company can only manage a certain bucket of risks. Most of the risks end up falling on the customers. We call them shippers in FERC terms. Here in Alaska, we probably call them the producers. But the risk is going to fall on them. They have the risk of developing the gas resources. We're going to supply a cost estimate on our pipeline and a tariff. But essentially, they pack the risk if we overrun that estimate. Now, they also take the risk of what are the markets going to be when they deliver that gas in North America. And I think the final one is that currently in Alaska, they have the risk of what are the fiscal terms going to be for the life of the project. My concern right now is I'm very confident we're going to have an excellent and very credible cost estimate. We're going to have good commercial terms. We're going to go out and offer those to our customers. My concern is that customers are going to have conditioned agreements with us. Conditioned meaning, I'll sign up, but somebody's got to do something about taxes in the state of Alaska before I can sign up. And by that I mean, what are the taxes going to be over the life of the project so you can calculate your economics? Right now, we don't see anyone dealing with that. So I think we're going to be ready at open season, but I do have a concern that our customers are going to have a number of conditions that I can't address as a pipeline company. And in the end, we may be looking at another open season or something beyond that if that occurs. I think the other thing that we have to also recognize is we're feeding into the North American market. And if you follow the gas price at all, it's dropped dramatically. There's also additional resources that have become available over the last few years, shale gas in particular. Our project has to be economic, and it has to compete with those other sources of supply, or it won't happen in the end. And the sooner we can get that done, the better off we are. So right now, we're really pleased with our progress. We will be ready to conduct an open season in 2010, and we're anxious to find out what these shippers are going to do. Thanks a lot, and I'll be happy to take some questions.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with Bud Fackrell, president of Denali, the Alaska Gas Pipeline. He was recorded addressing the Alaska World Affairs Council on Friday, October 30th at the Hilton Anchorage. Just go to KSKA.org to watch the Google Earth movie Mr. Fackrell shared during his presentation, depicting the entire pipeline corridor from Prudhoe Bay to Chicago. You can find a link to the movie and Mr. Fackrell's slideshow presentation on our website at kska.org. Following his talk entitled Denali, an update on the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project, a world-class effort with global implications, Mr. Fackrell responded to questions from the audience.
There is a competing gas line project being considered and being developed parallel with the work that you're doing. And I'm curious, because I'm not quite sure I understand, are there going to be two open seasons, one for the Denali project and one for the TransCanada project? Will they be simultaneous, or will one come before the other? And what does that mean for the strategy of shippers in deciding how to respond to these two open seasons?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Yes, there will be two open seasons. We've had conversations with FERC, and they allow this to occur. So both projects will have an open season. Right now, they're both slated to be in 2010. Obviously, if you're a shipper, you probably want to see both offers on the table. In our strategy is simply we're willing to compete. We're happy to compete. We're just asking that we have a level playing field, and we believe we can get out there and compete. So, yes, there will be two open seasons in 2010.
Last time we built a large pipeline in Alaska, it ended up costing three times the estimate compared with where you're currently at. Have you learned from that experience, and what are you doing to ensure that that doesn't happen again?
You guys are full of great questions here. We hope we've learned from that experience. A lot has happened in project management over the years. When Lisa was introducing me, one of the things I spent about a year and a half on was developing a major projects management process for Amoco before the merger with BP. ConocoPhillips has done the same thing. We've learned a lot about project execution. So the cost of the project is very important to us. That's why building the cost estimate now is so important, that it is credible and it's well thought through, because we will get challenges from the producers when we go out and review our cost structure with them, because that's going to be their concern. If you say it's 30 to 40, how do I know it's not going to be 50? Because you're basing your economics on it. So I think we're in much better shape than we were when TAPS was built. But we have to spend a lot of time on that, and that means the next stage of the project is actually spending more money to do all the front-end engineering and design work before you go out and build it. It's like the alignment sheet that I showed you up there. We need to have built this pipeline on paper before we ever go out there and construct it. We need to know what the slope of the terrain is. We need to know if there's gravel there or not. We need to know what kind of method we're going to use to cross each of the river systems. That's what we need to have in place. And that didn't exist when TAPS was built to that extent.
Will you be using the same pipeline corridor as TAPS, or a new corridor?
It will be very similar to the corridor of TAPS. We have a right-of-way on the BLM land that we've filed for right now. What happens, it's a little wider as you start the engineering process, and we will narrow it down to almost a similar one to TAPS. It's not right on top of TAPS. It will be expanded a bit because you can't have them too close together. But it'll essentially be the TAPS right-of-way through Alaska until you get to Delta Junction, of course, because there's no pipeline from Delta Junction to the Canadian border.
It sounds to me like you're saying you're ready, the producers are ready, but Alaska isn't with its tax structure. Would that be a fair assessment?
We're going to find out that in open season, but I think it is a fair assessment. The producers have testified for a number of years that they need to have some sort of fiscal predictability. They need to know what the taxes are going to be over the life of the project. And at this juncture, nothing's been addressed in that arena. And so it shouldn't be a surprise for us when we go to open season, and one of the big conditions will be that item. And the more we talk with them, they reinforce that to us.
What organization is handling the negotiations with the First Nations in Canada? And do you have a feel for how those negotiations are coming?
We have a team inside Denali that is working with the First Nations. In fact, one of my vice presidents, Chris Furr, who is in charge of the A to B pipe, or the, excuse me, that's our own, in terms of the main pipeline, is handling that. We also have a team in Canada, and we have people on the ground in Canada who have been out and visited all the First Nations. I will tell you, it's been up and down. We're trying to sign what's called cooperation agreements with the First Nations. There's 23 of them we're dealing with. We signed, I think, three or four, and there's some that don't want to sign with us. And so we're trying to understand what their issues are. But this is going to be a process. And I think the important thing is we're out there talking with them and that we don't get ahead of ourselves. Is, you know, we're still years away from construction, and we need to be sure we have a commercial project before we commit to commercial terms with them. And so we're working our way through that project. It is still going to be one of the more delicate issues that we have to address. And we found that in Alaska on TAPS. That was one of the crucial issues.
Who and how will the decision be made, whether it's the Denali or the TransCanada, since it obviously won't be Sarah?
You never know. Frankly, in the end, the market will dictate that. You know, I think in the end, the markets will dictate that. When there is a project out there that has the terms and conditions that will attract the producers to sign up, that project will go forward. And let me just kind of mention the magnitude of this. Let's say the project's $30 or $40 billion. Don't know what it is yet. When they sign up a tariff, they're going to sign up for a $100 billion commitment over a 25 to 30-year life of the project. And I'm going to ask them for take or pay. You know, whether they put gas in there or not, they pay the tariff. They're not going to sign that up until they understand the risk that we've just talked about. And one of them is taxes, but there's also price of gas on the other end and market. So people often ask me this, was who's going to decide? Somebody the other day said, I wish the feds would approve this. This is not a federal issue right now. This is an Alaska issue, and it's an issue about letting the marketplace work for itself, but then having the government here understand what it's going to take to make that occur.
Who are the most logical customers for the gas, and where are they located?
Well, what we've been talking about is North American markets, probably the Midwest is generally, I think, the markets that are going to need the gas. You know, our customers will be the producers who own the resources on the North Slope, BP, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, Chevron, the state of Alaska. They will then take that and feed to their markets, which will be in the Midwest area. And if you look at that, the map I had up there, there is a market to California, to the West Coast as well, and there may be some gas that ends up there. There's three or four ways to get out of Alberta down into the U.S. I think the majority of the gas is going to end up in the Midwest.
Would you talk a little bit about steel? You're talking about a fantastic amount of steel, and I'm wondering where you're going to get it and how you're going to anticipate the price.
There's probably 2 to 3 million tons of steel involved in the project. Right now, there are no U.S. or Canadian mills that can manufacture 48-inch, 1-inch thick pipe. So you're looking at mills in Europe and Japan. We're estimating it. Perhaps some of them, as we get into the project and get it authorized, will go ahead and modify their plants, and perhaps we can do some manufacturing in the U.S. But this is a big piece of the logistics, is moving all of that to where we're going to lay it on the ground. What we will have to do is get into those mills early and get in their queue and lock up the source of steel for the pipe. We obviously can't do that right now. So one of our risks is locking up, you know, steel mills in time to deliver our project schedule.
If and when this is built, what do you see your long-term role being? Or what are you planning after it being built, that is?
Well, long-term, I think, here's the kind of the bottom line for Alaska is gas pipelines or projects of this nature generate revenue over year after year. It's a constant revenue stream. You know, a project like this doesn't have a high rate of return, but it has a stable income source for many, many years. You know, what the jobs directly impacted are created by the pipeline when we're in operation. And, you know, there are 400 or 500 jobs to operate the gas treatment plant, the pipeline, and so forth. Where the jobs are created, though, is the revenue that comes off the project, and then the opportunity for people to explore for oil and gas up and down the corridor. So I think that is kind of, when you have a future vision of where you're going, is, you know, I think this opens up gas discoveries off of, you know, in the Beaufort, in the Chukchi Sea, potential gas on the North Slope. We now have an avenue to bring those to market. Brooks Range, we know there's some gas there already. It just creates a whole leveraging basin opening opportunity. And I've seen this occur before. I've been involved in several projects, one in Trinidad where that was exactly the case. One of our vice presidents in Denali was involved in the pipeline that went from Azerbaijan into the Mediterranean, and they're now delivering over 1 million barrels of oil and 1 billion cubic feet of gas. There's two pipelines there. So it just creates lots of opportunities, and I think it's very important to Alaska. Our revenue stream is dropping from the oil production, and right now, you know, the Chukchi, the Beaufort, and Anwar are kind of all locked off. There's not, the cavalry's not running over the hill, so we need it here in Alaska for revenue for the future of the state.
I might like if I think open season will take place before the governor's election in November next year.
We got some smart people out there, don't we? Right now, we haven't set when our open season will actually occur in 2010. I'm not in a race to beat TransCanada open season. What I want to do is be sure that we're ready for open season when we go to open season. We're pretty comfortable we can conduct it in 2010. And, you know, when we get our cost estimates in and so forth, then we'll trigger when we actually go into open season. So you're going to have to stay tuned on that one.
This may not be a fair question, but what in the world is Exxon up to? Are they want a share of the $500 million that the state put out, or is there some relationship with Mackenzie Delta Gas? Do you able to answer that?
I don't have any insights into the boardrooms of Exxon. All I can say is it's good that Exxon is now a player. You know, I would have preferred they signed up for Denali, but I'm glad they're a player because they have a large volume of gas, and we all need that. Other than that, nothing else has changed. Exxon has not signed up for AGIA, so you still have all of the producers saying the terms and conditions of AGIA are not viable to move this project forward. You know, and recently the governor's talked about he wants all three of the producers to come together, and he would potentially negotiate with them. The problem is AGIA. AGIA stands in the way of that occurring because, TransCanada is bound by the terms and conditions because they're being paid. My owners don't agree with AGIA. So, you know, we've got a roadblock in that area. But so Exxon's playing now, but nothing else has changed from an AGIA standpoint. The rest of it you'll have to ask them.
Thank you. I wonder if you could talk about two things. One are your plans for sequestration. Sequestration, are you thinking of enhanced oil recovery or permanently storing it? And also, if you could address the potential impacts of a cap-and-trade scenario. Have they been factored in to your cost estimates?
Yeah, both of those are really good questions, and frankly, the second one, we don't have a real good answer on that yet because we don't know what cap and trade is going to end up being. From a sequestration standpoint is Prudhoe Bay injects a significant amount of gas today, and we will most likely will be giving the gas, the CO2, back to the producers, and they will be reinjecting it in Prudhoe Bay. Some of that can be used for enhanced recovery. Some of it will just be sequestering it so it isn't going in the atmosphere. There are other fields on the North Slope that their production could be enhanced by CO2, and perhaps that'll be used in that way as well. We're trying to sort out what the cap and trade is going to be and where we're going to end up with that. It is one of the risks on the project that, you know, is a little uncertain right now. I think, you know, because of our sequestration of CO2, because we will be using state-of-the-art equipment with the new facilities, we feel pretty good that we're going to have a project that is has a lower CO2 footprint than, you know, something you would have built 10 years ago.
Question on the Open Season 101 course. Who ultimately approves the Open Season? And if it is FERC, then can they approve both, or they only have to approve one, or recommend maybe merging of the two competitive proposals?
Before I address that, let me just back up for a second here. Number one, there will only ever be one pipeline built. There's not enough gas for two pipelines. So what FERC is doing is in ensuring with their process that everyone who wants to bid on a pipeline or be a project themselves has an opportunity to fairly do that. So what they will approve is that your open season package is complete and that your process is fair. They're not going to pick a winner. They'll do that for both projects. So in the end, both projects cannot sign up all the producers. Only one will be able to do that. So the market will determine which project kind of wins from a FERC standpoint. What they will do is ensure that the process is fair, that you have everything you need that's required in that process. So in the end, they will give us a certificate. They could actually give two certificates on the project. I don't know that they've done that, but theoretically, the chairman has said they could give two certificates. That doesn't mean the project will go forward, though, because you still have to have customers signed up in those commitments.
With the three major producers, BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon, also very involved in McKinsey, could you help shed some light on dovetailing, or how does McKinsey Field fit into this from a supply point of view? What's its gas resources, and obviously there's other pipeline possibilities there as it impacts marketability and also the markets in the future for gas?
Yeah, I'd be happy to comment on that. Actually, BP doesn't have any interest in McKinsey. ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil do. I was in Canada last week, it seems like last year. I was in Canada last week and I met with Minister Prentice, who actually holds the file for the McKinsey project. In the way we viewed this, and it is McKinsey's Canada's number one priority because it's Canadian gas and they're going to make more money on it. But if the timeline holds true, McKinsey would come forward before the Alaska Gas Project. So we don't see it competing in that frame. In fact, you could talk about a scenario that you take workers from McKinsey and you move them over to the Denali Project, which fits nicely together. We'll have to see if McKinsey continues to move or not. Right now, he said they're expecting the joint panel review of the environment in December, and then they've got a process after that. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA. This week, you heard Denali, an update on the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project, a world-class effort with global implications, a talk given by President of the Denali Gas Pipeline, Bud Fackrell. Following his talk, he responded to questions from audience members. If you'd like to watch the Google Earth movie depicting the entire Denali Pipeline corridor from Prudhoe Bay to Chicago, or if you'd like to view Mr. Fackrell's slideshow presentation from the Alaska World Affairs Council, just visit our website, kska.org. Whether or not you hear it on Addressing Alaskans, all Alaska World Affairs Council programs continue to be available on our website. To find out more about the weekly Alaska World Affairs Council podcast, just go to kska.org and click on AWAC Presents. Volunteers Michael Cook and William Toyer record the programs each week, making them available for you on kska.org. Featured this week on Addressing Alaskans, President of the Denali Gas Pipeline, Bud Fackrell, was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council on Friday, October 30th, 2009. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.